The heavy studied voice of the butler broke the silence. Now, he said, let us not have panic. You, Bert, pointing to a footman, go and call the police, call Dr. McIntosh, and I think you should call the undertaker as well. Having concluded that oration, he gestured imperiously to the footman and turned to the two bodies. Pulling up his trousers so they should not crease over his knees, he stooped down and very gingerly caught hold of the wrist of the chambermaid, exclaiming in extreme distaste as his hand encountered blood. Quickly he removed his hand and wiped the blood off on the chambermaid's skirt. Then, grasping the poor maid by one leg, by one ankle, he pulled her straight out of the bathroom. There were subdued titters as the poor maid's skirt rolled up around her waist and up to her shoulders, titters which were quickly suppressed at a glare from the butler. The housekeeper stepped forward and demurely bent down, and in the interests of modesty rearranged the chambermaid's skirts around her. Then two men servants lifted the chambermaid and hurried down the corridor with her, trailing blood from her blood-soaked clothes as they did so. The butler eased further into the bathroom and looked cautiously around. Ah, yes, he said, there is the instrument with which Sir Algernon ended his life. He pointed to a blood-stained open razor which had skidded along the floor to the side of the bath. He stood like a monolith in the bathroom doorway until the sound of galloping horses was heard outside. Then there came the footman who said, "The police are here, Mr. Harris, and the doctor is on his way." There were excited voices in the hallway and then a very heavy, very majestic tread came up the stairway and down the corridor. "Well, well, and what have we here?" said a rough voice. "I understand that there has been a suicide, but are you sure it is not murder?" The speaker, a policeman in blue uniform, poked his head into the bathroom, automatically reaching for the notebook ever ready in his breast pocket. Taking the stub of a pencil, he licked it and then carefully opened the notebook. Then there came the sound of a fast trotting horse, and more commotion at the doorway, followed by a much lighter, much quicker tread on the stairs. A slim young man came along carrying a black case. "Ah, Mr. Harris," said the young man who was, in fact, the doctor, "I understand you have some illness here, some tragedy maybe, eh?" Now, doctor," said the red-faced policeman, "we have not finished our investigations yet. We must find the cause of death." "But, sergeant," said the doctor, "are you sure that he really is dead? Shouldn't we see to that first?" Mutely the sergeant pointed to the body and to the fact that the head was almost cut off from the neck. The wound gaped wide now that all the blood had drained out of the body and seeped all over the bathroom floor and all along the carpet in the corridor. The sergeant said, "Now, Mr. Harris, let's have your account of it. Who did it?" The butler licked his nervous lips as he was not at all happy at the way things were turning. He felt as if he were being accused of murder, but even the meanest intellect would have seen that the injuries on the body were self-inflicted. But he knew he had to keep in with the law, and so he started, "As you well know, my name is George Harris. I am the head butler to this household. The staff and I were startled to hear a chambermaid, Alice White, screaming, her voice going higher and higher until we thought that our nerves would break under the strain, and then there was a thud and nothing more. So we raced up here and we found—" He paused dramatically, and then thrust his hands in the direction of the bathroom and said, "This." The sergeant mumbled to himself and chewed at his moustache, a long drooping affair which had trailers at each side of his mouth. Then he said, "Produce this Alice White. I will interrogate her now." The housekeeper came bustling down a corridor saying, "Oh no you won't, sergeant, we are having to bath her, she is covered in blood and she has a fit of hysterics. Poor soul, I don't wonder at it either. Now don't you think you can come here bullying us because we did not do this thing, and I'll have you remember all the times you've come to my back kitchen of a night to have a good meal." The doctor moved forward very gingerly, and said, "Well, we'd better have a look at the body. We seem to be wasting a lot of time and getting nowhere in the process." So saying, he stepped forward and carefully took the links out of his starched cuffs, put them in his pocket, and then rolled up his sleeves, after passing his jacket to the butler for his care. Stooping down, The doctor carefully examined the body without touching it. Then, with a quick movement of his foot, he flipped the body right over until it was facing up with the staring eyes gazing up. The entity who had been Sir Algernon was looking down in fascination at all this. He felt very strange about it. For a moment he could not understand what had happened. But some force kept him pinned to the ceiling upside down, the living Algernon gazing down into the dead, glazed, bloody eyes of the dead Algernon. He rested upside down against the ceiling in rapt attention, spellbound at the strange experience. His attention was riveted at the words of Mr. Harris. Yes, poor Sir Algernon was a subaltern in the Boer War. He fought very nobly against the Boers and he was badly wounded. Unfortunately, he was wounded in a most delicate place which I cannot describe more adequately in front of the ladies present, and increasingly of late his inability to, perform has led to bouts of depression, and on numerous occasions we and others have heard him threaten that life without his necessities was not worth living, and he threatened to end it all. The housekeeper gave a sniff of commiseration, and the second housemaid sniffed in sympathy. The first footman muttered assent that he, too, had heard such things. Then the doctor gazed at all the towels so neatly arrayed on the racks and with a quick movement spread them all on the bathroom floor. With a foot he swept away the blood which even now was commencing to coagulate. Then, turning his eyes to the bath rail, he saw a bath mat there, quite a thick thing. He placed it on the floor beside the body and knelt down. Taking his wooden rod stethoscope, he unbuttoned the clothing of the corpse and put the wooden button end to the chest and applied his ear to the recess shaped in the wood at the other end. Everyone was still, everyone held their breath, and then at last the doctor shook his head in negation, saying, "No, life is extinct, he is dead." With that, he removed his wooden stethoscope, tucked it inside his trousers in a special pocket, and stood up, wiping his hands on a cloth handed to him by the housekeeper. The sergeant pointed to the razor and said, "Doctor, is that the instrument which ended this body's life?" The doctor glanced down, moved the razor with his foot, and then picked it up through the folds of the cloth. "Yes," he said, "this has severed from the carotid through the jugular and onto the carotid. Death must have been almost instantaneous. I estimate that it took about 7 minutes to die." Sergeant Murdoch was very busy licking his pencil and writing copious notes in his book. Then there came a heavier rumble as of a wagon being drawn by horses. Again the doorbell pealed in the kitchen. Again there were voices in the hall, and then a dapper little man came up the stairs, bowed ceremoniously to the butler, to the doctor, and to the sergeant in that order. "Ah, is the body ready for me?" he asked. "I was asked to come here and collect a body, the body of a suicide." The sergeant looked at the doctor looked at the sergeant, then they both looked at Mr. Harris. "Do you have anything to say about this, Mr. Harris? Do you know if any of the corpse's relatives are coming?" asked the sergeant. "No, sergeant, they would have no time to come here so quickly. I believe the nearest relative lives about half an hour's journey by fast horse, and I have already sent a messenger. I think it would be in order to have the undertaker take the body away to his parlor because, obviously, we cannot have the relatives seeing Sir Algernon in such a deplorable condition, can we?" The sergeant looked at the doctor and the doctor looked at the sergeant, and then simultaneously they said, "Yes." So the sergeant, as the representative of the law, said, "All right, take away the body, but let us at the station have a very full report at the earliest possible moment. The superintendent will want it before the morning." The doctor said, "I shall have to inform the coroner of this. It is probable that he will want to conduct an autopsy." The doctor and the sergeant moved away. The undertaker gently shooed away the butler, the footman, the housekeeper and the maids, and then two of his men came up the stairs carrying a light casket. Together they put the casket on the floor outside the bathroom and removed the lid. Inside it was about a quarter full of sawdust. Then they moved into the bathroom and lifted up the body, dropping it unceremoniously into the sawdust in the casket, carefully putting the lid back into position. Perfunctorily they rinsed their hands under the tap and, not finding any clean towels, They wiped their dripping hands on the curtains. Then out they went into the corridor, treading half-congealed blood all over the corridor carpet. With many a grunt they lifted the casket and proceeded towards the stairs. "Bear a hand here, you men," called the undertaker to two footmen. "Take the lower end, we mustn't tip him out." Two men hurried forward, and carefully the casket was eased down the stairs and out into the open, and slid into a black-covered wagon. The undertaker got inside, the two assistants got up on the box. The reins were picked up and the horses ambled off at a leisurely pace. Sergeant Murdoch moved ponderously up the stairs again and went into the bathroom. With a cloth he picked up the open razor and put it aside. Then he carried out an inspection to see if anything else of use as evidence could be found. The spirit of Sir Algernon, glued to the ceiling, looked down in utter fascination. Then for some reason Sergeant Murdoch turned his eyes to the ceiling, emitted a bellow of fright, and fell down with a honk that cracked the toilet seat. With that the spirit of Sir Algernon vanished, and he himself lost consciousness, being aware only of a strange humming, a weird swirling, and clouds of rolling blackness like the smoke from a paraffin reading lamp which had been turned too high and left unattended in a room. And so darkness fell upon him, and the spirit of Sir Algernon took no further interest in the proceedings, at least for the time being. Algernon Reginald Street. Claire de Bonkers stirred uneasily in what seemed to be a deeply drugged sleep. Strange thoughts swarmed across his half-submerged consciousness. There came bursts of heavenly music followed by wild outpourings of hellish sound. Algernon stirred fretfully, and in one period of greater consciousness he stirred and found to his astonishment that his movements were sluggish, torpid, as though he were immersed in a gooey mess. Algernon Reginald Street. Claire de Bonkers woke up with a start and tried to sit erect but found his movements constricted. He could only move in slow motion. Panic struck and he tried to flail about in his anguish but found his movements were slow, turgid, and it calmed him down quite a lot. He felt for his eyes to see if they were open or shut because he could see no light. It did not matter if his eyes were open or shut, there was no sensation of light. He put his hands down to feel the texture of the bed, but then he shrieked in shock because there was no bed beneath him. He was suspended, as he himself put it, like a fish stuck in syrup in a fish tank. For a time he feebly flailed with his arms as does a swimmer, trying to push against something so he would have the satisfaction of getting somewhere. But as hard as he pushed with his widespread hands and arms and his thrusting feet, so did something hold him back. To his astonishment, all his efforts failed to make him breathless, failed to make him tired, so, having seen the uselessness of an attempt at physical effort, he just lay still and thought. Where was I? He thought back. Oh yes, I remember, I decided to kill myself, I decided that it was useless going on as I had been going on, bereft of female society because of the nature of my disability. How unfortunate it was, he muttered to himself, that the filthy boars should have shot me there. For some moments he lay there thinking of the past, thinking of the bearded boar who had raised his rifle and deliberately, quite deliberately, aimed at him not with a view to killing him, but with the definite objective of what must politely be termed robbing him of his manhood. He thought of the dear vicar who had recommended Algernon's house as a very safe refuge for servant girls who had to earn a living. He thought, too, of his father who had said while the young man was still a schoolboy, "Well, Algernon, m'lad, you have to get to learn the facts of life, you have to practice on some of the servant girls we have here, you'll find them quite useful to play with but be sure you do not take things too seriously. These lower classes are there for our convenience, aren't they?" Yes, he thought. Even the housekeeper had smiled a peculiar little smile when a particularly comely young maidservant was engaged. The housekeeper said, "You'll be quite safe here, dear, the master will not bother you at all, he's like one of those horses in the field, you know, they've been doctored." "Yes, you'll be quite safe here," and the housekeeper had turned away with a sly little chuckle. Algernon reviewed his life in some detail. The shattering impact of the bullet and how he had doubled up and vomited in anguish. Still in his ears he could hear the raucous laughter of the old boar farmer as he said, "No more gels for you, Mlad, we'll stop you from continuing the family name. Now you'll be like them, the eunuchs we used to hear about." Algernon felt himself grow hot all over with the shame of it, and it reminded him of the long-term plan he had made, a plan to commit suicide following the decision that he could not go on living under such strange conditions. He found it quite intolerable when the vicar called upon him and made oblique references to his ailment, and said how glad he would be to have such a safe young man help with the women's meetings and the Sunday afternoon sewing sessions and all that sort of thing because, the vicar said, we cannot be too careful, can we? We must not impugn the good name of our church, must we? And then there was the doctor, the old family doctor, Drive Mortimer Davis, who used to ride up of an evening on his old horse Wellington. Dr. Davis would sit down in the study and together they would have a comfortable glass of wine, but the comfort was always ruined when the doctor would say, "Well, Sir Algernon, I think I should examine you. We have to make sure you do not develop feminine characteristics because unless we exercise the most extreme supervision you may find that your facial hair will fall out and you will develop, female breasts. One of the things for which we must be most observant is for any change in the timbre of your voice because now that you have lost certain glands the chemistry of your body has changed." The doctor looked at him most quizzically to see how he was taking it, and then said, "Well now, I think I could do with another glass of wine. You have most excellent wine here. Your dear father was a great connoisseur of the luxuries of life, especially with the distaff side of the luxuries. Hey, hey, hey." Poor Algernon had all that he could take when one day he heard the butler talking to the housekeeper, a terrible thing, you know, how it happened to Sir Algernon, such a lively virile young man, such a credit to his class. I know well how, before you came here and before he went to the war, he used to ride to hounds and made a very favourable impression on the matrons of the district. They were always inviting Sir Algernon to parties, they always looked upon him as a most eligible young man and a very desirable suitor for a daughter who had just come out. But now, well, the mothers of the district look upon him with commiseration, but at least they know he doesn't need a chaperone when he goes out with their daughters. A very safe young man. A very safe young man indeed. Yes, thought Algernon, a very safe young man indeed. I wonder what they would have done in my place, lying there on the battlefield bleeding with my uniform breeches soaked in red, and then the surgeon coming along in the field and cutting off my clothing and with a sharp knife just amputating the tattered remnants of what made him different from a woman. Oh! The agony of it! Nowadays there is this thing they call chloroform, which is stated to relieve pain, to give one surcease from the agony of operations, but on the field, no, nothing but a slashing knife and the bullet between one's teeth so one can bite down on the bullet and stop oneself from screaming. And then the shame of it, the shame of being deprived, the sight of one's fellow subalterns looking embarrassed and, at the same time, uttering salacious stories behind one's back. Yes, the shame of it, the shame of it. The last member of an old family, the de Bonkers, who came over with the Norman invasion and who settled in that very salubrious part of England and built a large manor house and had tenant farmers. Now he, the last of the line, impotent through service to his country, impotent and laughed at by his peers. And what is that to laugh at? He thought, in a man becoming maimed in the service of others? He thought that now, because he had fought for his country, his line would fall into desuetude. Algernon lay there, neither in the air, neither on the ground. He could not decide where he was, he could not decide what he was. He lay there flapping like a newly landed fish, and then thought, am I dead? What is death? I saw myself dead, then how am I here? Inevitably his thoughts turned again to events since his return to England. He saw himself walking with some difficulty, and then carefully noting the expressions and the actions of his neighbours, of his family, and of his servants. The idea had grown that he should kill himself, that he should end a useless life. He had at one time locked himself away in his study and got out his pistol, carefully cleaned it, carefully loaded it and primed it. Then he had put the muscle to his right temple and pulled the trigger. Just a sodden thunk had resulted. For moments he had sat there bemused, unbelieving. His trusty pistol which he had carried and used throughout the war had betrayed him at last. He was still alive. He spread a sheet of clean paper on the desk in front of him and lowered the pistol onto it. Everything was as it should be, powder, ball, and cap, everything was perfectly in order. He assembled it again, powder, ball, and cap, and without thinking he pulled the trigger. There was a loud bang, and he had shot out his window. There came running feet and a pounding on the door. Slowly he had risen to his feet and unlocked the door to admit a white-faced, frightened butler. "Oh, Sir Algernon, Sir Algernon, I thought some dreadful mishap had occurred," said the butler in considerable agitation. "Oh no, it's quite all right, I was just cleaning my pistol and it went off. Get a man to replace the window, will you?" Then there had been the attempt at horse riding. He had taken an old grey mare and had been riding out of the stables when a stable boy had tittered and murmured to an ostler, "Two old mares together now, eh, what do you think of that?" He turned and struck at the boy with his riding crop, and then flung the reins over the horse's neck, jumped to the ground and hastened back to his home, never to ride a horse again. Then another time he thought of that strange plant which had come from the almost unknown country of Brazil, a plant which was supposed to give instant death to those who chewed its berries and got the poisonous juice down one's throat. He had done that, he had such a plant which had been presented to him by a world traveler. For days he had carefully watered the plant, nourished it like a first-born child, and then when the plant was blooming and healthy he had taken off the berries and stuffed them in his mouth. Oh! The agony of it, he thought, the shame of it. No death, but things a thousand times worse than death. Such a gastric disturbance. Never in all history, he thought, had there been such a purge that he could not even take himself in time to the littlest room. And the shock of the housekeeper when she had to take his very soiled clothes and pass them to the laundry woman. His face burned red at the mere thought of it. And then this latest attempt. He had sent up to London to the finest swordsmith of that city, and there had been obtained for him the best and sharpest of razors, a beautiful instrument deeply engraved with the maker's name and crest. Sir Algernon had taken that wonderful blade and stropped it and stropped it and stropped it. And then, with one quick slash, he had cut his throat from ear to ear so that only the support of the spine in the neck had kept his head upon his shoulders. So he had seen himself dead. He knew he was dead because he knew he had killed himself, and then he had looked from the ceiling and seen himself on the floor with rapidly glazing eyes. He lay there in the darkness, in the turgid darkness, and thought and thought and thought. Death. What was death? Was there anything after death? He and his fellow subalterns and other officers in the mess had often debated the subject. The padre had tried to explain about the life immortal, about going to heaven, and one dashing hussar, a major, had said, "Oh no, padre, I am sure it's absolutely wrong. When one is dead and that's all there is to it. If I go and kill a boar, are you telling me that he'll go straight to heaven or the other place? If I kill him with a bullet through his heart and I am standing there with my foot on his chest, I can tell you that he's very much under me, dead. Dead as a stuffed pig. When we're dead and there's nothing more to it." He thought again of all the arguments for life after death. He wondered why anyone could say there was life after death. If you kill a man, well, he's dead and that's all there is to it. If there was a soul, then you'd see something leave the body at death, wouldn't you? Algernon lay there and pondered the whole matter, wondering what had happened, where was he? And then he had the terrible thought that perhaps it was all a nightmare and he had had a brainstorm and was confined in an asylum for the mad. Carefully he felt about him to see if there were any restraining straps. But no. He was floating, that's all there was to it, he was floating like a fish in water. So he returned to wonder what it was. Death. Am I dead? Then if I am dead, where am I, what am I doing in this strange condition floating idly? Words of the padre came back to him, "When you leave your body, an angel will be there to greet you and to guide you." You will be judged by God himself, and then you will have whatever punishment God himself decrees. Algernon wondered about that whole matter. If God was a kind God, why did a person have to be punished as soon as he was dead? And if he was dead, how could a punishment affect him? He was here now, he thought, lying quietly, no particular pain, no particular joy, just lying there quietly. At that moment Algernon started with fear. Something had brushed by him. It was like having a hand put inside one's skull. He got an impression, not a voice, but an impression, a sensation that someone was thinking at him, "Peace, be still, listen." For a few moments Algernon flailed away, trying to run. This was too mysterious, this was too unsettling, but he was stuck there. And so once again he had the impression, "Peace, be still, and be freed from this." Algernon thought to himself, "I am an officer and a gentleman, I must not panic, I must be an example to my men." So, confused though he was, he composed himself and let tranquility and peace enter within him. Chapter 3. Algernon suddenly shuddered with shock. Panic took hold of him. For a moment he thought that his brain was going to burst out of its skull. About him the blackness grew even blacker. Although he could not see in the total darkness, he could inexplicably feel turgid clouds of blacker than blackness swirling around, enveloping him. Through the darkness he seemed to see a brilliant ray of light, pencil thin, reaching out to him and touching him, and along the pencil thin ray of light came the impression, "Peace, peace, be still and we will talk to you." By superhuman efforts Algernon got a grip on his panic. Gradually he calmed down and once again rested more or less placidly, awaiting developments. They were swift in coming. "We are willing to help you, we are very anxious to help you, but you will not let us." Algernon rolled the thought around in his brain. "You will not let us," he thought, "but I haven't said a word to them, how can they say that I won't let them help me? I don't know who they are, I don't know what they are going to do, I don't even know where I am. If this is death," he thought, "well, what is it? Negation? Nothingness? I to be condemned for eternity to live in darkness like this? But even that," he thought, "poses a problem. Live? Well, do I live?" Thoughts swirled about him and his brain was in turmoil. Teachings of his early youth came to him, "There is no death, I am the resurrection, in my Father's house there are many mansions, I go to prepare a way for you. If you behave you will go to heaven, if you misbehave you will go to hell, only Christians have a chance for heaven." So many contradictory statements, so much misunderstanding. So much of the blind teaching the blind. The priests and the Sunday school teachers, people blind themselves trying to teach others who they thought were even blinder. Hell? He thought. What is hell? What is heaven? Is there heaven? A strong thought broke in on his cogitations, "We are willing to help you if you will first accept the premise that you are alive and that there is life after death. We are willing to help you if you are prepared unreservedly to believe in us and believe in that which we can teach you." Algernon's brain railed at the thought. What was this rubbish about accepting help? What was this stupid nonsense about believing? What could he believe? If he was to believe, then it implied there was a doubt. He wanted facts, not beliefs. The facts were that he had died by his own hand, and the second fact was that he had seen his dead body, and the third fact was that he was now in total blackness, apparently immersed in some sticky, turgid substance which prevented much movement. And then stupid people from he knew not where were sending thoughts into his head saying that he should believe. Well, what should he believe? "You are in the next stage after death," the voice, or thought, or impression, or whatever it was, said to him. "You have been misinformed, mistaught and misled upon the earth, and if you want to come out of your self-imposed prison then we will get you out." Algernon rested quietly and thought over the matter, and then he thought back. "Well," he thought strongly, "if you want me to believe, first of all you should tell me what is happening to me. You say I am in the first stage after death, but I thought death was the end of everything." "Precisely," broke in the thought or the voice very strongly. "Precisely. You are surrounded by the black clouds of doubt, by the black clouds of unreason. You are surrounded by the blackness of ignorance, and this isolation is self-made, self-imposed and can only be self-destroyed." Algernon did not like that a bit. It seemed to be blaming him for everything.